Papa goes on to say that. The Light of Vaishya contains the teachings of the Buddha. The Bhagavad Gita contains the teachings of Krishna and the New Testament of Jesus Christ. All these great spiritual masters of the world have declared with one voice, as it were, that unless we become perfectly pure in heart, we cannot realize God. That is the first thing we have to do before we can hope to attain God realization. So the struggle was to make his heart pure. And he tried to find out from the aforesaid teachings what he should do to get that purity which would help him in realizing the Self, with a capital S, the true Self. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said that if we constantly remember God by chanting his holy name, we will be able to attain purity. Jesus has said that we must love our neighbors as ourselves, which means that we must be kind, compassionate, forgiving, and helpful to all in the world without harboring any malice or enmity towards anybody. This is indeed a very hard thing. Still, it is a condition to be fulfilled before we can expect to reach God and feel his presence. We cannot feel his presence unless we have a mind absolutely free from lust, greed, and wrath. Selfishness is at the root of lust, greed, and wrath. All these evils will leave us only when we learn to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. If we are kind, compassionate, and forgiving to all, then it is that we develop this purity and see him everywhere. This is the lesson Ramdas learned from Jesus. Buddha also emphasized the need for attainment of perfect purity in thought, word, and deed. Our mind must be perfectly pure. Our words must be absolutely free from untruth, anger, and slander. And our actions also must be pure. This is what Ramdas learned from the Buddha. And reading from Master on the Attributes of Success. Success is affected by habit. It is not your passing inspirations or brilliant ideas so much as your everyday mental habits that control your life. Habits of thought are mental magnets that draw you to certain things, people, and conditions. Good habits of thought enable you to attract benefits and opportunities. Bad habits of thought attract you to materially minded persons and to unfavorable environments. Weaken a bad habit by avoiding everything that occasioned it or stimulated it without concentrating it in your zeal to avoid it. Then divert your mind to some good habit and steadily cultivate it until it becomes a part of you. There are always two forces warring against each other within us. One tells us to do the things we should not do, and the other urges us to do the things we should do, the things that seem difficult. One voice is that of evil, the other is that of good or God. Through difficult daily lessons, you will sometimes see clearly that bad habits nourish the tree of unending material desires, while good habits nourish the tree of spiritual aspirations. More and more, you should concentrate your efforts on successfully maturing the spiritual tree, that you may someday gather ripe fruit of self-realization. If you are able to free yourself from all kinds of bad habits, and if you are able to do good because you want to do good, and not merely because evil brings sorrow, then you are truly progressing in spirit. It is only when you discard your bad habits that you really are a free individual. Until you are a master, able to command yourself to do the things that you should do, but may not want to do, you are not a free soul. That freedom is not a small thing to gain, because in that power of self-control lies the seed of eternal freedom. I have mentioned now several important attributes of success: positive thoughts, dynamic will, self-analysis, initiative, and self-control. Many popular books stress one or more of these, but fail to give the credit to the divine power behind them. Attunement with the divine will is the most important of all attributes of success. Divine will is the power that moves the cosmos and everything in it. It was God's will that hurled the stars into space. It is His will that holds the planets in their orbits and that directs the cycles of birth, growth, and decay in all forms. Divine will has no boundaries. It works through laws known and unknown, natural and seemingly miraculous. It can change the course of destiny, wake the dead, cast mountains into the sea, and create new solar systems. We come together today in satsang, as it is called in India. Satsang means association with the true self, with who you really are in God. As in the Christian scriptures, the Hindu scriptures have the Trinity of God, Sat, Chit, Ananda. This one time watching Swami Satchidananda sign his name on various documents over and over again, writing out this long word, Satchidananda. And Sat means the pure, formless aspect of spirit that has no beginning and no end, that has no form associated with it. And so it is pure spirit. It is beyond mind. And really, it is beyond the mind's ability to conceive of it, because the mind is wedded to duality, and therefore it can't comprehend this supreme state of divine consciousness. And that is why we must go beyond the mind in order to realize the true nature of the divinity that resides within us and all about us. Chid is that pure intelligence or conscious awareness that projects out from that divine oneness as it goes out, and it is both reflective upon that divine oneness, and it is also aware of the multiplicity that exists within that oneness. This is also difficult for the mind to conceive, because we tend to think in duality. Can we be both an expression of God and also in unity with the Spirit of God at the same time? In the Bible, it says that we are created in the image and the likeness. Image is not an exact form. In other words, God does not necessarily look like a man or a woman or any object of nature. Rather, the image is the expression. It is what we were talking about yesterday, the expression of thought that then quickens itself and manifests as energy, the light body, the astral body. And then, if it chooses to, it condenses itself into a material body. And so all creation replicates these three stages, from thought to energy to materiality. And this is the image of God. This is the expression of God out as this universe. And so we all embody that. We are also made in the likeness, which means the spirit. That means we are beyond form. And we are one with God in divine spirit, beyond which there is no form, there is no expression. When we explore ourselves and go deeper within, because most of us are wedded to this body, we're wedded to this duality, we don't realize this formless, beginningless, endless aspect of Sat. And so we have to traverse the way back through the way that we came. So we have to go beyond this body. That is why Master here talks about going beyond the material mind, because this material mind keeps us from being able to acknowledge and to know the pure spiritual aspect. So we need to learn to master this body. For most of us, the life force comes in and it manifests out through the nerves, and we identify with this body and we think, well, this is who I am. This is what I remember. If I was something more than that, why would I not remember it? And yet, when you think back on your own life, most people don't have much other than fragment memories of before they were 6 or 7 years old. Did you exist then? Certainly you would say so. You see a toddler, you see a baby, you see a young child. They're very conscious, they're mentally aware as they grow older. And yet how little of those experiences we retain as a conscious memory. And yet those things were very important to us at the time. And they lay the foundation for who we become later on. So you wouldn't say that they're unimportant, and yet look at how little we retain of that as a normal state of waking conscious mind. Now, it's all there in the subconscious mind, but we don't necessarily have access to it. So how much more so do we have memories of who we truly are in the divine spirit, but how much further we have come from there, how we have learned to focus this mind on what those things are that are going around us at this time, those things that we anticipate for tomorrow, those things that happened yesterday. That's what fills our conscious mind. We completely forget the sat nature. And so we have to learn to quiet this mind because it's so busy all the time. You sit down to meditate and your mind races from here to there and everywhere except centering onto who and what you truly are. Now let us say you've made some progress in purifying the mind. And now, as you sit down, your whole attention goes to the ajna, that point between the eyebrows. And you forget the body, you forget the things of duality, and your whole attention gets centered in a singular way there at the ajna. And from the ajna, you swing upwards to the top of the head, the sahasrara, the crown chakra, that thousand petal lotus, or as talked about in Revelations, the 1,000 years of peace that comes with the return of Christ. Christ is that universal consciousness. And so you focus there and you rise up into that highest state of consciousness. And there, life energy sparkles and radiates out into all space. Beyond form, beyond time, you merge into that universal consciousness. And you realize this has always been your truth. It has never not been your truth. You realize that all the things that you sought for in the body, pleasure, freedom from pain, peace, happiness, joy, they're all contained in the supreme experience of rising up high in this consciousness. Only you didn't know it at the time. You were hypnotized into thinking that the body could offer these things. But what you've realized by going through incarnation after incarnation is that the body can only offer you temporary happiness. And even if you were to have the most perfect life ever, that eventually that life would come to a close. And one day, you would close your eyes, the breath would go out, and you would leave that body and that life behind you. There is no way to have permanency within the body. We're all renters here. We're not buyers. You can't own the body. You can't preserve it. And even if you were to put it into a cocoon and try to preserve it for all time, you can't do it. The spirit leaves. It goes away. And so, when we learn that, we learn some wisdom. I see. This body can offer me temporary pleasures, but it seems like with every pleasure comes a pain. It can, and whatever is given to me can be taken away. It's like building a house on shifting sand. Where can I find rock? Where can I find that sturdiness and that steadiness that will last me throughout all time? Is there such a place? And through inquiry into your true self, you come to know that, yes, there is such a place. Now, when we start out on this path, we have moments where we glimpse of that supreme consciousness, and we feel ourselves to be one with that. But it's not something that doesn't stay with us. We rise up into it, and when we come back down, we fall back down. Why? I remember one time being lifted up into such a high state, and then I just felt myself coming back down into ordinary consciousness. And it was such a radical difference between the two. And it was maddening. I didn't want to. But I realized later that what has happened in every such circumstance is that even though I was lifted up into that high state, some thought would float through the mind. And through my attachment to that thought, it would be like a lead weight on that balloon that would draw me back down to earth again. So it's not until we purify the mind completely and totally that we're able to be lifted up into that high state. And so the satsang, coming together to realize that true self, to that supreme state of consciousness, that there is a power in coming together. In traditional Judaism, you could only get a quorum by having a certain number in the group. And then it was said that you could have a quorum. But Jesus said, where two or more are gathered, there I am. So he is acknowledging that there's a synergy, that there is a power in coming together for that divine purpose. But that it doesn't require a certain number, but that when people come together for a like-minded purpose, there's a synergy, there's the uplifting power is more than the sum total of the individuals that are contributing to it. And so there's a power in it. There's an upliftment in it. And we learn to focus our attention. We learn to set aside the things of the world, just for a little bit even, and to focus our mind on those higher attributes, those higher experiences. We learn to awaken the desire inside of us. You know, it all really comes down to desire. Because our desire for God may be weak. Therefore, we have a practice, perhaps. We give some time during the week towards realizing these spiritual things. But the moment we leave that practice behind, the gravity of this world takes over. And it draws our mind back out in this world, and we completely forget any experiences we may have had when we are in that uplifted state of consciousness. There's more purifying to do. We have to do it. We have to do the work. And so we learn to dip ourselves into that divine consciousness steadily, over and over again, learning to bring it into our everyday life. We cannot have a spiritual life that says, this is my time for God, this is my time for the world. I have to go out and earn a living, you know. And it's not an easy life out there. So I have to prepare myself. I have to armor myself up. I can't be bringing those most tenderest and intimate experiences with me into the world. But that's denying the power of the divine spirit within you. It's not recognizing that as you grow in divine consciousness, you grow in spiritual power. Now, when I went through certain stages as I was rising up through different levels of consciousness, I would become very sensitive to this world. And it is true, as you learn to dive down deeper, it opens your intuitive body. And at first you feel very raw in your nerves as it senses the things from the outside. You pick up on people's thoughts and their feelings. Now this, in the Christian scriptures, is referred to as John the Baptist. He is the forerunner of the coming Christ. And so this is here at the solar plexus. That is those sensitive nerves that are just there where your ribs separate. And there's no muscles that are protecting. That's why if you get a punch there, it's really painful, knocks the wind out of you, because you have no muscles to protect that area. Those nerves on the physical level are wide open to this world. You see people, if they're feeling a little guarded or maybe in a conflict, they may cross their arms. And they cover that place in the solar plexus. This is the place of lower intuition. We don't want to be exposed there. And so you learn to guard yourself there, but that's because it's a very sensitive area. But as it begins to awaken, you get more conscious information that comes from that place. You meet somebody and you have immediate like or dislike of them. You feel an innate purity, or you feel something that's off with that individual or that place. There is a woman one time who was describing that she went with a group of friends, and they were sitting in a bar where people were sitting around and drinking, and she had a very uncomfortable feeling in her solar plexus about this place. And she told her group of friends, let's go someplace else. This doesn't have a good feeling to me at all. And nobody else was in favor. They were comfortable where they were sitting. And finally, she grew so uncomfortable with it, she had to get up and leave that place. And minutes after she had walked out of there, a gunfire fight erupted from some of the patrons who were there at that place. And some people were injured, and everybody was thoroughly frightened by the experience. Her intuition was saying, no, leave this place. This is wrong. Something bad is going to happen here. And fortunately, she was listening to it, and she didn't have to undergo the trauma that some of the other people did who remained there. So as we rise up in consciousness, this center opens up for us. And so this is the moon. This is the solar, lower solar center that is within us. It is a reflection of the divine light. The divine light comes in at the ajna. That's the point between the eyebrows. The Kutastha Chaitanya. It is the Christ center. And that is the higher place of intuition. When intuition comes in there, it is what Mother described as having a pure pipeline to God. Consciousness, it's not a reflected light. It is the light itself. It is the intelligence of the divine consciousness that is flowing to you. It is the experience that you have when you are lifted up in consciousness and suddenly you have a realization of something that you never knew before. Or if you had some knowledge of you, it still comes as a revelation and it deepens your understanding and perfect apprehension of that truth. And that comes in at this Christ center, the sixth center within your consciousness. And so this is the deepening of the intuitive mind. Now, how do we cultivate intuition? There are some people who use indirect methods. They may use tarot cards. They may use muscle testing. They may use other means in order to get access to the deeper consciousness. The problem with using indirect means is that you don't necessarily know what may be coming from your own subconscious mind versus the superconscious mind. In order to get direct access to the superconscious mind, we must achieve a certain state of purity within the body and the mind and the emotional body. If we don't do it, in all likelihood, what we're getting is feedback from the subconscious mind. And we can be fooled. So it says in the scriptures, test every spirit that comes to you. We have to be discerning. We can't just accept whatever floats up into our mind as direction from God. That would be a misuse of the word. And yet, so we can't play fast and loose with it. And yet, we don't want to set up such a barrier between ourselves and the divine that we think, oh, that could never be for me. That could be for somebody else. But I could never have that kind of intuitive insight. But we do have to do the work. We do have to purify our mind. We have to cultivate this divine love for God and for ourselves. We have to chant God's name. We have to have compassion for this world. We have to do this because that helps us to attune to the higher divine consciousness. Now we can know where the source is if we examine what the quality of this experience is as we get it. Because when we intuit from God's mind, then we are open to this divine consciousness in all of its aspects. And it doesn't just come as a thought or an idea. I remember the first time that I was reading about a good explanation of reincarnation. And some part of my intuitive mind knew that this was true. I just knew that this was true. But it wasn't for some years that as I continued to deepen and progress into the spiritual consciousness that I had any direct experience with any previous incarnations. And as these memories spontaneously arose within me, I realized the connection between that time and this time. That there's a direct cause and effect relationship, and it explained why many of the things that I dealt with. One of the early memories that I had was that what I came into this life with was a real sense of being something less than. Something less than the other people around me. And I had this kind of sense that everybody else was somehow above me in some way. And when I had this previous memory, I remembered myself that I had been a warrior at the time in England, and I had been struck down with a sword, cut in the spine, and paralyzed from the waist down. And it had been a painful time. I continued to live, but I was paralyzed. And so I was completely helpless, and I had to be helped in everything that I did, and it was humiliating. From having gone from a time of feeling powerful in my body and being able to do things and trying to increase the amount of lands and power that I had, now I was struck down and I was in this helpless state. And I recognized from my memory of that lifetime how much it had influenced me in this lifetime. And I carried the residue of that kind of feeling with me still. And so it's something that was given to me so that I could overcome it. When you get these things, they come to you so that you can go beyond it, not so that it triggers more of that feeling, not so that you indulge yourself in that, but rather that you can free yourself from it. So this is an important thing to be able to understand. Now, you don't have to go out seeking out after this information. If it's important to you, and if it's essential for your growth, then it will come to you as you go deeper into your consciousness. The danger in going after some of this information is that it can sidetrack you, and you can get caught up in the various kinds of incarnations, and then is it your imagination or somebody else's imagination, or is it true? And so there's a lot of pitfalls in there. And yet, if it's something that comes to you and it helps you to free yourself from some condition you're struggling with, then it is useful and it is helpful and it is needed at that time. So in order to open yourself to that level of intuition, you must learn to become quiet in your mind. Learn to still the restlessness. Now, Krishna acknowledges when Arjuna says, but the mind is very difficult to tame. And Krishna says, yes, sometimes it's like wild horses pulling you in every which direction. And so you don't have to go with all those wild horses, and yet it's a struggle. But that's why we practice. That's why we practice, not only when we're sitting for meditation, but also through the day. You learn to chant. You learn to focus the attention. You can practice Hong Sa. You can keep the mind attention at the ajna. When you work, you feel as if you are in service to God within the people that you see. Mother Teresa of Calcutta was such a wonderful example of this because her practice was to see the Christ in everybody that she met and to serve the Christ, not necessarily the human, but to serve the Christ in each person that she met. Can you imagine that If you thought of everybody that you met as the beloved of the divine coming to you in that form, and that you were attuning yourself to what it is that the divine needed in that form. Now, it's not always to fulfill all the desire natures of that form. That's not always what an individual needs, but to attend to its soul needs. And always and forever to give the love of God to that individual. Mother used to say that to each one of us she gave the love of God. And it sounded good. I heard the words. But it was difficult for me to know exactly what that meant. And it is as the love, the divine love, that is awakened inside of you that's different than human love. Because human love is focused on an individual, a place, a situation that attracts you, that gives you something of what you want. But then if somebody doesn't act in the way that you would like them to, and they act contrary to that, suddenly you can feel that love dry up, just like an old dried prune. And so it's gone. And it can actually even turn into anger and frustration and even hatred. The people that we are most likely to hate are the people that we have one time felt love for. Isn't that a strange thing? And yet it's true. That is human love. Divine love is different for that because divine love flows through you. It is impersonal. That doesn't mean that it's cold. That doesn't mean that it's aloof. It just means it's not dependent on what that person is doing or what they've done to you. It means that it is flowing through you because it is your nature to have that flow. If you are to go to a beautifully fragrant rose in the garden and to smell of that rose doesn't think, oh, here's a deserving person. I think I'll waft my fragrance in their direction. No, it's just its nature is to exude that fragrance. And so as a divine being, your nature is to exude a divine presence, and that includes divine love. And when you meet somebody, you feel that love as an active force within you. It's not sentimentality. It's not awakened by a particular thought or because somebody has done anything to you. It is just simply flowing out from you as the fragrance of that rose. And you feel it, and you feel blessed by it. And so whether that person recognizes the love that's flowing through you, whether they acknowledge it, whether they give anything back in return, it doesn't make any difference for you because you are fulfilled in the act of loving itself. So we can say that is selfless love because it's all contained within the self. There's no need for reciprocity. But when it is given back, it just adds to your joy. But in either case, your joy is complete. And so this is the mark of somebody who has risen into the higher divine realms, that this love is complete, it's whole, it's total, it's always there. And you give the love of God to everyone you meet. Now, Papa considered seeing God in everyone as the greatest way to help awaken God within that person. And he has many wonderful scenes in Quest of God and in The Vision of God, his own autobiography about his own spiritual life, where he meets with people and they're not giving very good God-like qualities to him or the people around him. And he recalled a scene where he was traveling on a scene with some other, on a train with some other sadhus, and the sadhus at that time, they didn't pay anything. They would just get onto the train, and they would travel, and if the conductor would kick them off at the next place, then they would all dutifully get off, and then they'd see if they could catch a ride on another train. And so they would ride like this, and many of the conductors, because it's India, they're sadhus. They didn't pay any attention whether they had tickets or not. They rode in third class. And so they get kicked off at the certain station, and the station master tells them to all go over and sit down in one place. And so they all go over and sit down in one place, and then the station master comes over with his kerosene lamp, and he's shining it in each one of their faces. And he says, no, 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 don't sit there. Get over and sit over in this other place. So they all stand up, and they all go over and they sit down in another place. And he comes out a few minutes later, and he says, what are you sitting there for, you dunderheads? Get up and move over there. And he tells them to move over there. Well, this happens over and again. And finally, one of the sadhus with Papa says, starts to grumble a bit. And he says, what's wrong with this fellow? You know, he keeps on telling us to move from here to there to the other place. And Papa says, never mind, Ram. He called everybody Ram. He says, God has taken mercy on us. He knows that our legs are cramped up from riding on the train all that time. He's just giving us some aerobic exercises by moving from one place to the other. So he saw everything as manifesting from the divine, whether somebody treated them well or not. Another place where they are booted off the train, and the station master was abusing one of the sadhus. He had them all lined up, and he grabbed his hair, and he was shaking him by the head back and forth in very rough treatment. And Papa saw that the sadhu had a big smile because he was accepting, oh, this is God who's come to me like this. So Papa stood in line next to the man, and then he tapped the fellow who was shaking the sadhu's head, and he said, you've given him enough fun. Will you do that for me for a while? You know? And part of the fun was when Papa would see unconditionally that this was God, people would stop this kind of behavior, and they'd suddenly wake up to something new inside of them. They'd feel that God awakening inside. And then they would begin to see things in a new light, a new light. Now, Papa's view of them was not conditioned on, oh, well, if they don't see me as God, or if they don't see the situation as God, oh, now I'm angry. No, he's unconditionally there. And people felt it. Yeah, and that's what changed them inside. So if you can imagine somebody who has unlovely qualities in your life, and they just, they bug you. They bother you, you know. They just, something in the interchange. You just, oh man, that person drives me crazy. Can you just imagine in yourself, nothing changes on the outside, but inside, you begin to see this person is God. Come to test me in this way. Come to see whether the mask is hiding the divine face behind the image. And to soften yourself towards that person. To see the divine within them. And first of all, what do you notice about the change inside of you? In your relationship with them. And then what would be part of the interesting experience is what do you see, if anything, is the change in the other person? And one of the things we come to realize is that in every interaction, it's a two-way street. And that oftentimes the people we have the most difficulty with is because they're sensing from us something that they're having trouble digesting. Who our attitude towards them, our feeling towards them. Whether we say anything or not, they get it. They know it. And they're reacting to that. And when we change ourselves, so many times, it changes them. I remember one time when I was doing psychological work for myself and learning to free myself of my parents. And at one time, in my mind, my dad was 90 feet tall. And gradually through the work that I do, he shrunk to about 9 feet tall, but still pretty tall. And then at one point, I remember he came down to about 6'3", which was his original height. And then as he got older, I think he even shrank a little bit lower than I was. So it all came down into proportion. And when I would go to visit, I would feel, oh, it's kind of boring and I don't enjoy it that much. And then I realized I was limiting myself. I was making a lot of presumptions of what was okay and what was not okay. And I decided to be myself. Why not? What did I have to lose? And yet it felt very threatening at the time to do so. So I decided to be myself. And lo and behold, my mother and father seemed to enjoy it. I got to be more alive. I would talk about things that I thought might be outrageous to them. They didn't think it was outrageous at all, or they didn't show anything about it, if they did. And I had more fun. And I realized I had imprisoned myself in the relationship, in the way that I thought about it. I thought they were imprisoning me. And I realized they had grown, if they had ever been the people who had imprisoned me in the first place, they had grown from that, but I hadn't allowed them in my own mind. And I had imprisoned myself. And so we look at all the circumstances where we imprison myself. Oh, I can't be myself there. You know, nobody would accept me. They would reject me. Well, all right. Well, even if that happens, if you're yourself, your true self, and you're free, don't you have a right to do that? If you're not harming anyone, if you're living up to the highest light both within yourself and what you feel to be in attunement with God, why not? Why not be yourself? Who God created you to be. And what Krishna tells Arjuna is, he says, when you don't live up to that, first of all, it hurts you. But secondly, it also hurts the world, because nobody can take your place. And if you don't show up to do your part, then the world suffers. So you must show up. You must be the person created in the image and in the likeness of the divine that you are meant to be. And to hold back and not be that is to both harm yourself and to harm the world at large. So this is our task in life, you might say, is to free ourselves from the limitations. Everybody has a role to play. Yesterday we were talking about prosperity. And I would like to define prosperity as having everything at your fingertips that you need to fulfill the divine plan as God has given it to you. For the CEO of a large corporation, that may be incorporating a lot. And what makes that person either in tune or out of tune is not what he has and what he doesn't have, it's what he does with what he has. And for another person, it may be wandering with very little or nothing, and yet they have absolutely everything they need. I met a most wonderful saint once, and many years ago. She went by the name of Peace Pilgrim. And she was, you might say, an ordinary woman who was in her 50s, who meditated deeply on God. She used to go for walks out into the woods. And she got this inspiration, and it came very powerfully to her. And she became a modern-day sadhu here in the West. And God told her, I want you to go and walk for peace. And so she put on a sweatshirt that had 25,000 miles for peace. And she walked. She didn't carry any money with her. The only clothes she had was the canvas tennis shoes she wore, the pants, a sweatshirt with two pockets where she could put her mail in it. She had her mail forwarded to her at different times from a friend who would collect the mail and then forward it to her. She would walk until given rest. She would fast until given food. And she just took out and she started walking on the streets. And people would see this sweatshirt, and they would ask her, what's this all about? And she would talk to them. And she would say that world peace begins with you. Find inner peace, and then let that spread out to all your friends, all your family. Act in that peaceful state of mind. And when enough people do this, this world will come to peace. And so that was her message, and she went out and she would speak at churches, anybody who would have her, anybody who would listen. And here she was. She was what we might consider an older person at that time. She didn't have any bedding with her. If she it came nighttime and she hadn't been given any place to rest, she would point down to a place on the concrete pad that she would see, and she'd say, "Okay, go to sleep here," to her body. Her body would respond, and she'd lay down and she'd go to sleep. And then she would wake up, and then she would start walking again. And she would walk until somebody offered her a meal. Now, after the 25,000 miles, 25,000 miles, then she went another 25,000 miles. So she had 50,000 miles for peace. And at the time that I met her, she would accept rides. And so I met her in Seattle at a college that I was going to. She gave a talk, and she allowed another Kriyabon and I to give her a ride to Bellingham, where she had a radio interview arranged for that afternoon. And I very much wanted her to meet Mother Hamilton, but because I thought they were kindred spirits and they would enjoy each other hugely. But it wasn't possible because she had this appointment in Bellingham. She had to go. So we gave her a ride, an hour and a half up to Bellingham, and she told us stories about her life and how things were. And you know, in all of her walks, she had never one day been ill. And she described one time being up in the Dakotas. She was walking there. Nobody had given her a ride. A snowstorm had come in. Now, just imagine, she's just got these canvas tennis shoes on, just a thin pair of pants, a sweatshirt with a shirt underneath it. That's all she's got. She's very cold. And I've known people, good, healthy young men, who have practically not made it to their destination of walking a mile or two because it gets so cold there. And she felt like she was on her last breath there. She was so cold. The wind was blistering. And there, out in the middle of a field, she spied underneath the snow this cardboard box, and she crawled inside and it protected her from the wind. And that's what made it possible for her to survive. And when the storm passed by, she got up and she started walking again. Such tremendous faith she had. And so she had not had one day of illness in all that time. Can you imagine? Being out in all the cold and the elements, all the people that she mixed with. And so she was a wonderful, wonderful saint. I felt very blessed in knowing her. And so that's the way that her life went until one day she died with her tennis shoes on, as I'm sure she would have liked to have done in service. She was on a head-on collision with another car that she was riding in. And so her God had decided her time was up. But I'm sure she would have preferred that, to be out on the road and doing what she's doing rather than a long, lingering kind of death. So God called her when he was ready to. And I think she must have been well into her late 70s by that time. So for us to not put limitations. You are made and in the likeness and image, and each person comes with their own destiny. And when you attune yourself to God, your destiny becomes clearer and clearer to you. You get into harmony with what you're really here for. And whether you're here to be manager of thousands or tenth of thousands of employees and help guiding and shepherding a company, or whether you're here to be as the Peace Pilgrim was and just living in utter simplicity, to be in harmony with why you are here. What is your Dharma? Why have you come? And when you know that, you have a credible claim on peace being exactly where you're at. So let us not forget that we are all made in the likeness and in the image of the divine. That the spiritual masters from time immemorial have been calling to us to awaken us to this great truth, and that truth is yours. I'd like to close with a song of Kabir, a wonderful mystic from India, said that was thought by many of Lari Maharshi's disciples that he was a reincarnation of Kabir. Kabir sings, "The Lord is in me, the Lord is in you, as life is in every seed. O servant, put away false pride and seek for him within you. A million suns are ablaze with light. The sea of blue spreads in the sky. The fever of life is stilled, and all stains are washed away when I sit in the midst of that world. Hark to the unstruck bells and drums. Take your delight in love. Rains pour down without water, and the rivers are streams of light. One love it is that pervades the whole world. Few there are who know it fully. They are blind who hope to see it by the light of reason, that reason which is the cause of separation. The house of reason is very far away. How blessed is Kabir that amidst this great joy he sings with his own vessel. It is the music of the meeting of the soul with the soul. It is the music of forgetting of sorrows. It is the music that transcends all coming in and all going forth." And what a beautiful song it is. So if you'll pray with me in closing. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet. And surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Within you. May you ever be blessed with the Divine Presence, continuously awakening within your heart and soul. Om.